In James chapter 2, verse 17, a very oft-quoted, familiar passage, faith without works is dead, being alone. Oftentimes, when we study the book of Romans, we quickly go to the book of James so that we can point out that we're not saved by faith alone, even though Romans doesn't say that. Or sometimes when we're studying the book of James, we point to Romans to make sure that we don't over-comment on works. But I don't think James wrote his book to make sure we didn't understand Paul, and I don't think Paul wrote his book to make sure we properly understood James. James probably wrote 20 years before Paul, so if he did, he certainly wasn't correcting Paul because he didn't know what Paul was going to say. But James or Paul, neither one needed someone else to explain what they were saying because they were both writing inspired. But I want to consider faith without works. What did James mean by that? And I want to take maybe a little different tact, a more personal tact for us to consider this morning. And I want to begin by asking three questions. And when I ask them, these will almost sound redundant, but trust me, I'm firmly convinced they are not. Number one, what do you and I really believe? Number two, what do you and I only think we believe? And number three, what do you and I only think we should believe? I believe the answers to all three questions are different. Sometimes markedly different. There are great beliefs. But how do we know what we really believe? How do you know if you really believe it or if you just feel like you should believe it? A lot of us were raised in the church. Do we really believe it or we just kind of feel we should believe it? There have been beliefs that people have died for and devoted their lives for. There are other beliefs that people, maybe instead of beliefs I should call them words, that people can rattle off without really ever asking themselves if they really believe them. How can two people claim to have the same beliefs and yet lead such different lives? How can two people claim allegiance to the church and yet one of them repeatedly subjugates their loyalty to the church to all kinds of other diversions? How can two people claim allegiance to marriage and yet only one of them remain faithful? How can two people claim to love the Lord and yet only one of them obeys? Well, I think the key to this is tied up in one word. Conviction. That's what I want to talk about. Now let's understand that a conviction and an opinion are two different animals. We all have opinions. We hold them to varying degrees, but our opinions are based in our preferences. It's my opinion that this is better than that. It's your opinion that that is better than this. We both have a right to that opinion. We're both right. We're both wrong. We're neither one right. We're neither one wrong. We just have different opinions. I understand that some of you will never really see the truth that Ford is the best kind of car to have. And I've quit trying to convince some of you that simply are not mentally nimble enough to see that. I've given up trying to make all of you understand that chocolate is really the only dessert that counts. But I don't want to convince you because, you know, that leaves more for those of us that are really see the light. Obviously, those are tongue-in-cheek examples, but those are opinions. It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Now, sometimes we think things are issues of opinion when I don't think they should be. I've had people tell me, even within the church, a cappella singing's a matter of opinion. I don't believe that. But when we toy with our opinions, we're only toying with preferences. But when we start toying with convictions, now we're not toying with our preferences anymore. We're toying with our conscience. Because a conviction is something rooted in our conscience and in the Word of God. So that when we try or toy with our convictions, we are going to have to toy with our conscience. And conscience runs far deeper than preferences. It's far more important. Now, we do need to sometimes compromise preferences. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 21, it says, submitting yourselves one to another. I don't know how to do that unless we all kind of give on our preferences, because we don't always get our way. You don't in the church, you don't at home, you don't at work. But when we start talking about compromising of the conscience, then we're starting to deal with sin. As James says in James chapter 4, verse 17, to him that knoweth do good and does it not, to him it is, you can finish that, sin. Paul himself in Romans chapter 14, verse 23 says, he that doubteth is damned if he eat, because he eateth not of faith, for whatsoever is not of faith is of sin. I believe the key here in faith without works is dead is really James trying to teach us a lesson that we don't always see, and it's a lesson about conviction. There are really three different levels of conviction. Michael Novak, a writer, touched on this, and he labeled them. I'm going to use his labels, not his words necessarily. The first one is what we will call a public conviction. Now, what's a public conviction? Well, a public conviction is one that we want others to think we believe. So we say it. Even if it may not really be what we believe. And we do this all of the time. Maybe, hopefully, not so much in the religious realm, but we may do it in the religious realm. A wife comes into her husband and says, do the wrinkles on my face make me look old? And he says, I didn't even know you had wrinkles. Well, he's probably not being quite honest with that. Or a wife comes in and says, her husband says, does my receding hairline make me look more debonair? And she says, oh, yes. Well, maybe it does and maybe it doesn't. Public figures all of the time are notorious for stating a conviction for the purpose of making an impression rather than communicating truth. This is the greatest nation ever. It's a good nation, but I don't know that it's the greatest nation ever. I kind of hope it isn't. Every election is the most momentous election ever. Well, how can they all be? This is the greatest generation ever. No, those are statements made to sound good that people like to hear, but they don't really show probably the true conviction of the stater, and they don't always express the truth. This is nothing new. In Matthew chapter 2, verse 8, Herod says, go and find the Christ child that I may worship him. Well, worshiping Jesus was the furthest thing from Herod's mind. You know that. But that was his public proclamation of his conviction. Political correct speak. Sometimes being even part of the church, the community of faith, increases our temptation and pressure to pretend we believe what we really don't believe, because we think, well, everybody else there believes that, and if I want to go there and live in peace, I better say I believe that. But it's not really what you believe. There's a book in the Red Song book, I Surrender All, and we've probably all sung that. Do we really believe that? If I were to ask you, do you believe in prayer? Almost everybody, if not everybody, assembled here this morning would say yes. Well, if that's the case, why are some of our prayer lives so anemic? If I were to ask you, is this the most precious book in the world? You would probably say yes. If so, why does it sometimes collect dust? My point being that public or verbal affirmations of what we say we believe are not necessarily what we really believe. That's why in Matthew chapter 7, Jesus says, "By your fruits you shall know them." And a little later, in verse 21 and following, he says, "Many will say unto me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not done many wonderful things in your name? And I will say, Depart, I never knew you." People expressing public convictions that really weren't what they believed. But we need to move on for the sake of time. Private convictions. Now these get a little closer because these are the convictions that we may say publicly, but these are the ones we really think we believe. I really think I believe that. My point this morning is that may or may not be what you and I really believe. We think we believe it. But sometimes those beliefs are illusionary. We might think we believe something, but it turns out that when the circumstances change and run another way, we don't believe that really. Private convictions seem real at the time, but when circumstances change, they're shown to be hollow. This particular event was recorded in more than one gospel, but I'll just reference Mark chapter 14. Verse 29 and following, Jesus comes to Peter and says, "Peter, before the night's over, the cock crows, you're going to deny me three times." What does Peter say? My words, no way. You think Peter really believed he would that? I think Peter was totally sincere and he 110% believed he would never do it. Well, you just drop down a few verses and you know what happens. What happened? He did it. His private conviction didn't turn out to be really the truth. I don't question Peter's sincerity. I believe he believed it when he said, "Lord, I'll never deny you," but he did it because the circumstances shifted. Examples. Every one of us may think that assembling on the first day of the week to worship the Lord is important. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. Now, some may be here for other reasons, but in general, you wouldn't be here. But yet, when we want to do something that conflicts, what do we sometimes do? When we want to take a trip that is not going to allow us to do that, what do we sometimes do? Well, you have to make that decision for yourself. I'm just saying, do you believe it? Do I believe it or do I not? I've never married a couple that didn't intend to stay married all of their life. But I've married some that haven't. We feel or we believe, we tell ourselves that we put Jesus first. Ever seen people when chip came down, they put family before church and God? Sure you have. My point again being that simply telling ourselves that we believe something, that's important. Saying that we believe it, that is important, but that still doesn't prove to me or you what we, you and I, really believe. Which leads me to my third one, that we will call core convictions. And if you will allow me to use the phrase, this is now where the rubber starts to meet the road. This is not what I necessarily say I believe. It's not even necessarily what I tell myself I believe. This is now what really I believe because it is what guides my life. I believe that fire burns. And I believe that so strongly that I don't get up every morning and light a match and stick my finger on it to see if it's still true. I believe it is true. I believe I have to breathe in order to live, so I don't get up every morning and hold my breath until I pass out just to check to see if that's still true. I believe that gravity is essential to keep you and I on earth, so I don't go find a fruit tree and sit under it and have it fall on my head to prove gravity. I believe those things, and so do you, so deeply that my whole life is congruent to them. And my actions are always congruent to those beliefs. That means that in order to really understand what you and I believe, we have to become students of our lives, because our lives show what we believe, not what I say or even what I think. Now, I know we can be hypocritical, but to ourselves we're not hypocritical. We know. Let me give you a personal example of this, and it's not a religious example. When I was growing up, my dad was afraid of heights. I love heights. The higher the better, the steeper the better. So as a little 8, 9, 10-year-old kid, whenever something needed to be done on the roof, dad'd send me up. And I mean, it was a treat. And you could slide down those gutters and probably make them leak, but you could slide, you could just do all kinds. And he was scared, so he couldn't come up and get me. So I was up there as long as I wanted to be. Well, something happened between the time I was 10 and now, because I don't like heights anymore. So I set my ladder up against my gutters at home, and I've given myself a 3-hour pep talk, because I've seen guys bigger and older and clumsier than me get on my roof and do whatever and come down and do fine. So I know it can be done. So I start up the ladder. When my eyes get level with the gutter, my feet stop. I don't know how many minutes minutes I've stood on the ladder saying, you can do it, you could do it, and nothing happens. And my wife knows nothing's going to happen, so she just waits and she knows I'm going to be back pretty soon. See, my mind knows that people can get on my roof and do it. And I will tell you that people can get on my roof and do it, but it is not a core conviction, because I can't do it. So I send the boys up. That's why you have kids. To do those things you don't want to do anymore. See, my actions really tell me what I believe. What I believe. In Matthew chapter 7, verse 1, it says, judge not that you be not judged. Now, we understand in John chapter 7, verse 24, it tells us to judge righteous judgment. But sometimes we say we believe, judge not, but yet we judge. In James chapter 4, verse 10, humble yourself in the sight of the Lord and he will lift you up. But don't our egos get in our way a lot of times? Oh, the arrogance in the lives of almost everybody is absolutely amazing. Oftentimes, even the humble are arrogant of their humility. In Acts chapter 20, verse 35, it's more blessed to give than receive, but our wallets don't always show that, do they? You know, faith is coming to believe with our whole being, not just with our minds and certainly not just with our mouths, what we believe. Therefore, the best indicator of our true belief and true conviction is our actions, day in and day out. Better than our public and even our private convictions. And that's why Jesus says, by your fruits you shall know them, in Matthew. Many of you have probably seen, or maybe some of you have even been in high school, a classic musical. Oh, it's probably 50 years old, I don't know. Fiddler on the Roof. And it's a story of this Orthodox Jewish Russian dairy farmer. And I think he has 5 daughters. I can't remember the number, but I'm just going to talk about the first 3. And it takes place a little over 100 years ago, back in about the turn of the century. Teve is his name. And under Orthodox Judaism at that time, it was customary for the father or the parents to pick who their sons or daughters would marry. Teve had these daughters. And he had dutifully, over the years, just picked out the perfect guy for each one of the daughters. Problem is, all of the girls had a little different idea than Tebbe. The first one comes to Tebbe and asks permission to marry a poor tailor instead of the rich butcher in the village that Tebbe had picked out for her. So Tebbe goes away in kind of the seminal scene of this whole musical and has a little talk with himself. And he lists all the reasons why it would be okay for his daughter to marry the one she wants to. And then he says, but on the other hand, and then he lists all the reasons why she should marry the one he wanted. Well, he's outnumbered. Tebbe gives in. She marries who she wants. Daughter number two comes and asks his blessing for her to marry a revolutionary, which was not the guy that Tebbe had picked for her. He goes through this little ritual again in this classic scene and lists all the reasons why I guess it's okay if she marries this soldier. But then he says, but on the other hand, and he lists all the reasons why it'd be better if she married the one he picked, Tebbe gives in again. Daughter number three now comes and wants to marry a Gentile. Now, we've just revved it up. For an Orthodox Jew, that just can't be. So Tebbe goes off in this scene, lists all the reasons, trying to convince himself it's okay for her to marry this Gentile boy. And Tebbe says, but on the other hand, and then he stops and he says, there is no other hand. Now, what happened in that scene, and the reason I took the time to share that with you or remind you of it is, when we reach our core convictions, there is no other hand. You do it. And if you don't, it's not. Period, exclamation point. When you reach a core conviction, you do it. And if you don't, then it is no longer a core conviction. I'd like to take just a couple of more minutes, which in evangelist speak, that means 10, and have you consider one other belief that I think all of us would say we have. If I were to ask myself and you, do you believe God is watching over you all of the time? Seeing what you do. I bet we would all, of adult age at least, say yes. Well, let me ask us, a couple of questions. If a policeman is sitting in the back seat of your car, does it affect the way you drive? A policeman doesn't have to be in my back seat, just in my rearview mirror is good enough. My mother lives 3 hours from us, and periodically, several times a year, we will invite her up and she'll spend a week with us. She's a nice lady, doesn't cause any problems. But I'm going to be honest with you. Donna and I, it changes the way we conduct ourselves. Let me put it that way. And without getting overly specific, I have to remember that Mom's sitting in the living room so that when I come out of the bedroom, I'm a little different than if she isn't there. We'll just say that. I've often thought that if our mothers were with us all of the time, there'd be a lot less sin in the world. But that's not my point. If I really believe Jesus is with me and watching me every step of the way, why doesn't it affect our conduct a little bit more than it does? And then I ask myself, well, is it a core conviction of mine? Or have I been able to wall it off so that I think he's taking a nap every once in a while so I can do what I want? You know, when you look at the Gospels, it's interesting to note the disciples began having faith in Jesus. They ended up having the faith of Jesus. Quite a tremendous transition took place there. Their deepest conviction was that Christ was not wrong, because faith certainly involves certain beliefs, but it also involves our core convictions. You know, I believe many people trust Jesus for eternity, but they won't trust him for tomorrow. And what I mean by that, they trust Jesus, their faith is in Jesus to get them to heaven, but they don't have enough faith and trust in Jesus to have them live tomorrow like he tells them to, or today. Because eternity seems a long way off. Well, the only way you and I are going to get to eternity is if we do what he says today and tomorrow, isn't it? I think that may be why James wrote, faith without works is dead, because he was really trying to tell me and you, you got to get down to your core convictions, and those have to be your elements of faith. Not what you say, and not even what you have convinced yourselves. Look at your lives. John, look at your life. You look at your life and find out, what do I really believe, and quit kidding ourselves. Because sometimes that's exactly what we do. Some people who claim to be Christians are selfish, greedy, and opportunistic. Others who claim are humble, generous, and consistent. Both may say they have faith or trust in Jesus, but their true convictions about reality and the way they are to live are night and day apart, aren't they? And they produce two very different peoples, even if they claim, and even if they have convinced themselves they believe the same thing, their lives say, no, they don't. If one's public and private convictions are 100% biblical, but they walk in arrogance, greed, self-desire, and lovelessness, you're headed in the wrong direction. Another person may be rather immature biblically or theologically. They may be internally struggling with doubts and uncertainty, but they show forgiveness, grace, love, and generosity. That person is 10 times closer to the Lord than the person that maybe has even memorized the whole Bible. Frederick Buechner wrote, "You can believe there is no God and live as if there is, but you can also believe there is a God and live as if you don't." What he was basically saying is, you can be an atheist and still live as if you believe there's a God, but you can claim to be a Christian and live your life as if you really don't believe. Buechner was saying, your conduct shows what you believe. Now, I don't believe an atheist who acts in a good way is going to be saved, because we do have to believe in God. You know that. I know that. But isn't it interesting, in all of Christ's teachings, what he consistently says to his disciples is, follow me. He doesn't say what I said. He doesn't even necessarily talk about their private. He says, follow me. That's a conduct statement. Because he knows if they are going to truly follow him, then their convictions are their core convictions. When you really think about it, therefore, the key to life lies not in our public convictions, although those are important. We need to proclaim Christ. Not necessarily even in our private convictions, although I hope they're right, but in our core convictions, because those are the rudders of our lives. Not what we say we believe, and not even what we have convinced ourselves to believe, but what we really believe because our actions show it. Those are your core convictions. Whether we're talking about church, whether we're talking about family, whether we're talking about work. Don't tell me how much you love your mate. Show them. Don't tell me how much you love your kids. Show it. Don't tell us each other how much we love the Lord. Show it. I think we should stand up and proclaim our Christianity, but I think there is some truth in the statement is the only people that have to tell people they are Christians are people that don't show it by their lives, because if you show it with your life, people will know it. Final comment. Thomas Carlyle. Conviction, I'm quoting, no matter how excellent, is worthless until it converts itself into conduct. I'm back to my first three questions. What do you really believe? Well, your life holds the answer. You may have even convinced yourself you're right with the Lord. But let me urge all of us to go back and look at our conduct and see if it's right with the word of the Lord. Because if it is not, then we're not. It doesn't matter how much rationalizing I do and you do. Eventually, you got to get down to your core convictions. And they're not very hard to get to because your life is a book for everybody to see. I think what James was telling us in James chapter 2 when he said faith without works is dead is that unless your faith reaches down and becomes your core conviction, then you got nothing. It's easy to say it. It's even easy to convince ourselves we believe it. But until it becomes that rudder of each of our lives, we got Zippo. It's an illusion. And that faith is dead. We're going to close our thoughts and extend the gospel invitation. This is an invitation to proclaim, to convince yourself, but also now make it the rudder of your life. Maybe you haven't been baptized and you need that. Well, if you haven't, you sure do. It's not judgmental to stand up here and tell you that unless you have been baptized, you will not, cannot go to heaven. That's not John speaking, that's God speaking. If you've fallen away, unless you get right with the Lord, heaven is not your destination. You know, on computers, they have what are called default settings. That's what your computer does unless you change it. I don't understand all my default settings on my computer, but I know what my human default setting is. My default setting in life is hell. That's where I am going to go if I don't do anything. If I want to go to heaven, I've got to change the default setting. I've got to do something. That's what this invitation is about. Change your default setting and put it on heaven. If we can help anybody in any way, we invite you to come as we stand and sing.